From Pod Center, this is the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPNRadio.com.
Welcome in. With Ryan Russillo, I'm Scott Van Pelt. Scott Van Pelt Show here on ESPN Radio, ESPNRadio.com. Football tonight from Cleveland. If the NFL Network was told that you'd have a 500 team against a one-win team, potentially bad weather, the building will be somewhat full to start, it'll be empty by the middle of the third quarter, you'd think this is not a show I'm interested in watching.
Do you think the NFL went with our premise yesterday of trying to pick the three worst bowl games, and they got together this summer and said, hey, here's an idea for our Thursday nighters?
Let's give you this. They've got some good ones coming up. This game on paper doesn't look like much until you realize that this is, in my opinion, the most popular team in America. I know Dallas fans recoil at that, but Pittsburgh, I'm saying they're America's team. They won the Super Bowl, and they're 6-6. And if you want to be taken seriously as a playoff team, you cannot lose four in a row. You certainly can't lose five in a row. And included in that five losses, B, losses to Kansas City, to Oakland, and to Cleveland. They cannot lose this football game. I don't believe they will. But I'm finding myself in a strange place here, which is on shaky mental ground with a Pittsburgh team that I admittedly like a lot organizationally from top to bottom.
And I enraged some people by saying I still felt like they had a chance to do some special things this season. When I watch them play, and I've watched them through this stretch where they keep losing, it's their inability to close games. Somebody called them the anti-Mariano Rivera. But when you look at their losses, 3 points, a score with 15 seconds left against Chicago, Cincinnati, the first time they lost to them, 3 points, that loss, a play with 14 seconds left.
And there were two different fourth down conversions on that drive for Cincinnati prior to the touchdown score.
Kansas City, overtime. Baltimore, overtime. Oakland this past week, 9 seconds left. So you're looking at five of their six losses as being 3 points and all happening with 15 seconds or less in the game.
May I interrupt for 1 second and just point out that while that is interesting and compelling evidence that it's not like they're getting their doors blown off, great teams win close football games.
I'm not selling them as great.
Okay.
I'm selling them as a team that has a record that may not be an indication of what they are.
You are what your record
says. No, you aren't.
Sure, sure you are.
Everybody likes it because Parcells said it, so we repeat it all the time. That's not accurate.
No.
So what happens when a team...
You're six... Because you know what? When the tournament starts, that's another Parcells-ism. When the tournament starts, then people aren't going to say, oh, you know what? You don't get seeded higher because we think you're better than you are. You are 6-6. So even though these are close losses, you're not getting a better seed because we take you at face value.
Well, there's two ways to separate it, though. What you're allowed to do based on your record or how good of a team you are, the perception of you. So when Tennessee was 0-6, were they really an 0-6 team?
People
one of the worst
ship,
franchises?
People jumped ship like it was Titanic.
Okay, but if you're 0-6 and you are what your record says you are, as we all like to repeat all the time, then that means you're one of the worst franchises in the NFL. And just a disaster. Nobody wants anything to do with you. And you come back and win five in a row. So I would argue that Tennessee at 0-6 was not an 0-6 team. And they proved that the rest of the way. But we're not talking about Tennessee. We're talking about a Pittsburgh team that when Troy Polamalu's there, they can't close these drives that beat them all the time.
Okay.
The defense has actually been better from a point standpoint the last six games than they were the first six games. But one other alarming trend, because Roethlisberger, you could argue, has only had one bad game this season.
Mm-hmm.
They've had the worst kickoff coverage in like 16 years. When you look at the total, and I'm not going to stat you to death here, but they are so bad in elements of their special teams. They give up so many yards in comparison to what they're able to do that they can't finish, and their kickoff returns are killing them that are coming against them.
Okay, so because does the loss of Polamalu, who may not be back this year, or may, you never know, he just doesn't know at this point, does that influence and impact how you perceive them this year and being able to move forward because they can't close these games out?
Yeah, they're 4-1 with him, 2-5 without him. If they don't have him the rest of the way, based on what I've seen in the secondary that just is falling all over themselves at the end of these games when they need to make a play, then yeah, it would change it. But if there's a chance he can come back, I still think it's a team. I don't know that there's a lot of people that are AFC fans that are going to be saying, oh, we get Pittsburgh in the first round?
No, you shouldn't.
Awesome.
No one's psyched. No one's psyched to get them, clearly. This just proves what we've talked about over and over again every summer when we try to forecast what will play itself out over the course of an NFL season. There's no way mentally you can wrap your hands around the fact that Pittsburgh off its Super Bowl win is going to be 6-6 going to Cleveland in December. And that's where they are. And it's impossible to allow yourself to think that that can happen. And it has. And it's harder now because of that to allow me anyway to see them being a 10-6 team at the end of this. I just to think that they would sweep their final games. I don't know if that's realistic. And 9-7 becomes problematic given that there's so many teams in play here. So if you just look at what's realistic given where they are, the unleashing of hell must begin tonight with a win in Cleveland, who played a bit better against San Diego. They backdoor cover, but they scored and they moved the ball and they gambled a lot in red zones and didn't score. I can't fathom them losing five games in a row. I just can't see that happening. So I assume Pittsburgh gets a win tonight, but I don't know how much better that makes me feel about them. In fact, I don't think it makes me feel that they are a real threat, even though I get your point.
Remaining schedule, I agree. Got to win tonight. And I don't know what to make of a team and just a short turnaround. Tirico's pointed out a bunch of times when he's joined us here on the show, the brand of football on Thursdays hasn't been the quality that you see on Sundays because of that turnaround.
Especially this time of year.
Because guys are hurt all the time. But Cleveland, Green Bay, Baltimore, at Miami to finish this up, you have to get tonight because of the way it's looked. But when I say you look at them and say 6-6, their 6-6 is different than other teams' 6-6.
And I wasn't picking on your point. I agree with it, but it doesn't matter that their games have been close because ultimately the old analogy, you're even, there's no, it's black and white. There's no gray area that they almost this and they almost that. They could very easily right now be a 10-2 team. Very easily.
Just don't do the grocery quote today.
I won't do that. I won't do that.
The Scott Van Pelt Show.
With Ryan Russillo, I'm Scott Van Pelt. It's ESPN Radio. Did you catch the John Wall show last night? Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! My man has got game for days. Kentucky beats UConn. Very entertaining college basketball game. We came on for SportsCenter right after it. And you, Ryan Russillo, watching in your house, the palatial downtown high-rise glamorous estate you occupy, two TVs, the NBA TV and the college TV. And the college TV is like the little black and white with the rabbit ears. Did you move Wall to the big TV, or did you just find yourself watching the Wall experience on the TV?
I was actually doing something last night where I was like, okay, I'll sacrifice not watching my Johnnies against Georgia, and I'll tape it. And then I was somewhere where they're like, hey, I think UConn's on. I'm like, yeah, in 24 minutes. And it was pretty obvious that I wanted to leave, not because I wasn't having a great time, but because I obviously wanted to get back and watch this game. And one of the things I always laugh about is when I'm looking at the NBA game, because as we all know, I love this game.
NBA apologist.
I'm watching, and then I'll look over and be like, look at that college game. There's a lot more activity going on there. And I just switch it, and you just see the NBA has its pluses, its minuses. But when you watch a game like Kentucky-UConn last night, you realize these kids are killing each other for a loose ball 4 minutes in when it's like 14 apiece.
And Kentucky has all of these shiny new pieces. Wall, Cousins, Bledsoe, Dodson, and on and on and on. To go with Patterson and experience big, Coach Cal brings a new enthusiasm and bounce in the step of Kentucky fans. Here's what I see with your team. You beat North Carolina and UConn the same week in December. You'll be better by March. Are you a legitimate threat to win six games in a row in March? Sure, I suppose there's no reason why I would say you're not. My one question and concern is this. Do the pieces of the puzzle, each one of which who is accustomed to being the guy and getting his shots and his looks and whatever, do they all fall into line or do they all try to be alpha males? That'll be a challenge. I think you see Cal trying to exert his will over this team. That's why he's been telling them they stink all year so far. They don't stink. They're good. And for folks in Lexington, enjoy John Wall while you got him because he's a ghost. He'll be in the NBA next season and he'll be the first pick in the draft.
And he was the difference last night against a UConn team that plays a similar fashion.
Sure.
Open, very aggressive defensively, great athletes, but they both look like it's very clear that UConn and certainly Kentucky are not finished products.
Not
both
yet.
Subbing in a lot, trying to figure it all out.
But you're not supposed to be in December.
No, you're not. But other teams are, and that's the number one team in the country.
Right. And so we both agree. Like Kentucky a lot. Still a work in progress. If they once this cake is baked, it might be quite a tasty treat. But Kansas, what's interesting about them and what's different about them is that you have roles clearly established. Sharon Collins, their guard, their point guard from Chicago, stays 4 years, rugged, tough. He has got he's got the minerals. He's got the goods. He's not afraid. You've got Cole Aldrich, a post that's a polished post in college, which you don't have many of. You got Xavier Henry, who, like Wall, is a freshman who'll be in the league next year.
I mean, he's a freshman. He's scoring 17 a game for this team.
And because they've got alpha males, he doesn't have to come in and try to be anything more than what he already is, which is just, he's the icing on the cake. That's why If Kentucky played Kansas tonight, could they beat him? Sure. I just think I like what Self already knows he has because there are fewer question marks as they move through the balance of conference play.
Now, another team that is in that conference, the Big 12, is the number one defensive team, at least early on, and that's Texas.
Love them.
They're loaded with talent again, but I think you're starting to get to the point with Rick Barnes. We're 11 seasons in now at Texas. He has the Final Four in 03 with T.J. Ford, but is there going to be a season where all this talent comes together and you end up having a really special season out of Austin?
You made a great point about this off air. Who's quietly put more pros in the game than Barnes in Texas?
Quietly?
I just don't feel like people give as much credit for Texas being a producer of NBA type players. But
yeah,
they put plenty out there. And I really like them. Pittman, who is an enormous guy who I have dubbed size, is better than people remember because he's more in shape is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, right? No, he looks better this year.
Thank you. I just didn't want to say he was a fat guy. Now he's not a fat guy. but that's I believe accurate. And speaking of freshmen, we just talked about Xavier Henry. We just talked about Wall. Avery Bradley, love his game. If you haven't seen him, you'll like the way he plays. But I like Texas a lot too. There are a couple of other teams that I've seen. Where are you on Purdue? When you watch them play, what do you think of them big picture?
I love them. I loved them last year.
See, so do I. They play so hard. What was Billis's line?
Billis had a line about Kansas State. He said, if anybody plays harder than him, I'd like to see him. And I believe I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, oh, but I have seen Purdue. It essentially saying that this is one of the best teams when you're looking for effort night in and night out. And they're loaded with experience, maybe not a scary individual like these other teams we're talking about.
Bingo. You can watch Wall, and his skill set is so obvious. He scored 12 of the final 15, the bucket to win the game in 25, and it's obvious what you are. You watch Hummel play with that crazy Evansville shot that Matt Painter explained last year. That's how the kids are taught. They shoot from the middle of their forehead, and it looks wild. Juwan Johnson's this big, lanky guy that likes to face up sometime, but then all of a sudden he's blocking shots and rebounding, and Moore, and then Kramer, their guard, who he's not a pro, but he's a pain in the butt Big Ten guy to deal with.
And, yeah, he just looks like a fullback out
right,
there.
Right, and playing them is just it's just like death by 100 paper cuts.
You made a good point, though, because even though defensively they get after it, and everyone does, I mean, you want to talk about defined roles, understanding what you have to do, but are they a team? Do you always need that NBA talent to win a tournament? Do you need five games to, if you're going to try to win five and get to the finals or get to at least the Final Four and win those four, do you need a couple guys that are going lottery?
Yes,
and history tells you you do.
To me, the two most important qualities to have this decade in trying to win a tournament, there's two things, pros and experience. You need to have a little bit of both. And when I look at Purdue, can they be a tournament team that's a high seed? No question about it. But can they be the type of team that wins six games in a row? I don't know that they are, because I don't know who their pros are. And when you look back the last couple of years when they've made it to the tournament,
they won two games last year and then ran into UConn and just it wasn't really a close game.
Right, but if they run into a more athletic team who they're better than record-wise but just can't outscore, maybe that's an issue. But they've looked very, very good to me. And I'll just give you a 10-second ACC apologist synopsis on Duke. They're a little better inside than I remember. And Dawkins, the kid who should still be in high school, is very, very good. And North Carolina's guard situation will have to get better. Their bigs are good. They just don't have much experience at all in the backcourt. They're both highly ranked. I think there's still some significant question marks about both those teams.
I would agree.
The Scott Van Pelt Show.
Well, Tim, we'll start with a tough one. What was the emotion like getting on the bus Saturday night to leave the Georgia Dome?
Well, there was a lot of emotion. There's a lot of frustration. And there's a lot of heartbreak because, you know, for so many years you put in the effort, you know, to go out the right way your senior year and to make those last memories so special. And we felt like we were so close, and to let it slip through our fingers in the SEC championship game was very tough. But you have to give a lot of credit to Alabama. They came in a great game plan. They were determined, and they were better than us last Saturday. And that's a tough pill to swallow, but you got to give them a lot of credit. And you know, we just have to get back to work and get ready for Cincinnati, which is a big game. And playing in the Sugar Bowl is a real blessing, although it's not, you know, what we had in mind before that game. It still is a blessing, and it still has been a good season. So you just got to keep those things in mind and keep it in perspective.
What specifically was the Bama game plan on defense that hurt you guys?
Well, Bama's defense?
Yeah.
Well, they tried to take away some things that we did well. They're really good up front in taking, you know, up space so that your running backs really can't find holes. And they did a good job with that. And then on third down, they do so many different looks, give you so many different looks back to every third down. It's a new look. And so you really have to be prepared to see everything. And they did a good job taking away some of our, you know, guys that we like to go to in third down and some of the plays that we like to run. And you just have to give credit to them, you know, for having a great game plan and also executing very well and making tackles, you know, not giving up the big plays. You know, there are several opportunities where we had opportunities, you know, to get third downs, you know, get that first down if we had a broken tackle or two and we just couldn't get through. We just couldn't make that last yard. We just couldn't finish. And then a few opportunities were in the red zone where we just couldn't, you know, punch. And that really hurt us down the stretch. And, you know, you just have to give credit to them. They played a really, really, really good game.
Florida quarterback Tim Tebow joining us here on the Scott Van Pelt Show. Tim, you'll be in New York again as a Heisman Trophy finalist. If I started to run through the accomplishments, it would take me forever. But this is three trips to New York. You've won a Heisman. You're part of two national championship teams. All the records in the SEC of consequence. That's the stuff we know about. But when you leave Florida, what will be your finest memories? Things that we know about from football or things that we never even saw?
Both. I think it would be the memories, you know, from the field, some of the big wins, those moments after the game with the coaches and players. But also what most people don't know is that, you know, my time just training in the summer with my teammates and coaches and us just sweating and grinding and working and growing as a team and just the memories together with the coaches and the players and even the fans and, you know, running out of that tunnel for the last time and taking the victory laps and shaking the students and the fans' hands and just enjoying my time in college and enjoying the people I'm around. You know, when I made the decision to come to Florida, it wasn't because that was my favorite school ever since I was six. It wasn't because they had a spread offense. It was because I wanted to be around the people that were there. I wanted to be around Coach Meyer and the coaches and the players, and I liked the people. And that's what it's been all about for me, and I really have been truly blessed to have a college career where I've been around a lot of people that I love and respect.
Tim, where do you see yourself next year as you move on from college football?
Well, my goal is next year to have an opportunity and a chance to play quarterback at the next level. That's been my dream since I was a little kid, and I'm going to do whatever I can to try to reach that goal. And I just want an opportunity and a chance to play quarterback at the next level, and I'm going to do whatever I have to.
What reaction do you have, though, when you have so many people that seem to doubt the abilities of your college career translating to the NFL?
Well, kind of all through, you know, my life, I've had a lot of naysayers, a lot of people supporting me, but then there's always been naysayers, even from high school and, you know, my freshman year, they wanted me to play linebacker and tight end instead of quarterback. And so I had to, you know, break through that and could go to a place where I could play quarterback and then come into college, you know. Well, I could only run the ball. And then my sophomore year, you know, can he throw the ball? And well, we threw the ball okay. And then the next year could we win a championship? And so it's just, you know, I'm trying to overcome obstacles and hurdles, which is one of the best parts of sports. There's something I love about it. It's just the challenges, the obstacles, the adversity. That's what makes sports so great. And, you know, and I'm going to work as hard as I can and try to use that as more motivation. I'm also just a pretty self-motivated kid. So I had a lot of motivation these next few months in trying to prepare to be an NFL quarterback, and I'll do whatever I have to do to get there. And if, you know, a team gives me opportunity and I can't do it, then put me at another position. I would love to do it. I'd love to do whatever I can to help the team, but I just want an opportunity and a chance.
Tim, I know how important it is to win the game against Cincinnati so that your final game is a win, so I won't ask a question that there's an obvious answer, but can you describe what you think it will be like and feel like when you look up in the Superdome and see zeros on the clock and realize you'll never again put on a Florida Gator uniform?
I think it'll be very emotional. I think it'll be hard to put that uniform on, that jersey on, that helmet, and run out with my teammates for a last time and know that I'll never be able to play for the Gators again is going to be very emotional and be very tough. And definitely when the game's over and, you know, the last time I'll be taking plays from Coach Adazio and Coach Meyer and Leffler and everybody, and it'll be tough. But it truly has been a blessing, and that's what I'm so thankful for, is my past 4 years have been better than I could have even imagined.
Say a few years down the road, you're back in Gainesville for some reception, some sort of banquet to honor your college career. How would you want to be introduced?
That's a good question. I think when they, you know, talk about me and they talk about what I did at Florida, besides, you know, instead of them talking about the championships or winning the Heisman or any of the stats that I put up, I'd rather them just talk about, you know, this kid, his 4 years at Florida, he gave everything to us, and he, every time he stepped on that field, he left nothing. He gave everything he had to his teammates, his coaches, and his fans, and he played with the most heart and the most courage, and he would do anything it took to win and to support those who are around him, and that's how I'd like to be talked about and remembered.
I think that's a great answer, and it finishes up here with this thought. Those that have watched you like we have, we know how fired up you can get. Your teammates have talked about it all the time. Brandon Spikes being interviewed about you always makes me laugh because he just has this look on his face. Wherever you are next year, because we know you're going to be on an NFL roster. We just don't know how that's going to play out. Will it be hard for you to not start screaming at guys on the sideline when you need a big third down even though you're just a rookie?
Well, I think you just try to naturally let your leadership abilities take over, but at the same time, you have to know your role and know what you're doing. And, you know, I was once a freshman at Florida, too, and had a similar role to what I'll have next year. And so you just have to be smart, respect those around you, respect your leaders, and just know exactly your role and what you need to do and how do you accomplish that. And I think I'll understand that and try to do it to the best of my ability.
Well, you just spent 10 minutes talking to two guys, and Ryan and myself, that love college football as much as anybody you'll come across. It really has been a lot of fun to watch you do your thing these last 4 years. Enjoy your trip to New York, your trip to New Orleans, and wherever the future may take you, Tim Tebow. All the best. You've been a credit to what you do in college football. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on. It's been fun talking to you for the past 4 years. Thank you.
The Scott Van Pelt Show.
Matt, you're at a stage in your career where you've accomplished so much and worked with so many people. I think of The Departed. It was almost like an all-star film in many respects, director and actors on down the line. But can you describe what it's like to get an opportunity to work with Morgan Freeman and Clint Eastwood on the same film?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, it's beyond anything I actually could have hoped for. It was the head of the studio of Warner Brothers who called me, and he'd known that I'd been talking about Clint for a long time, and I'd really wanted to, you know, I always said, because Clint's been at Warner Brothers forever, and I said, listen, if there's ever anything, you know, just please let him know that I'm ready, you know.
Right.
And he called, and he said, you're not going to believe this. I think I found the thing for you to do with Clint. He said, it's this incredible story. I said, well, what is it? He said, it's a Nelson Mandela movie, and Morgan Freeman's going to play Nelson Mandela. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this just... I mean, it really was. And they sent the script over, and it was one of those things where I just read it, and I called Clint, and I said, I can't believe this is a true story. I mean, and he said, no, that was my reaction too, but I've, you know, researched it, and this actually happened, the way it's laid out in the script, and it was a dream job.
The film is Invictus, and sport plays a role in it, but obviously you mentioned Mandela, and you've got the backdrop of apartheid and South Africa and all that entails. But I've said many times, Matt, I don't watch reality television because I watch sports, and so often sport provides something that you can't possibly believe. Just how do you feel that sport applies itself as a backdrop for film, and particularly in the case of Invictus?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you hit on something there. I mean, just now too, like even today with HD, like I find watching sporting events, it's kind of gone to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can really see the contest of wills. I mean, think of like playoff baseball, and you can look at the pitcher's eyes. You can actually see the guy up close, like he's in your living room, and you can look at the hitter's eyes, and you can know sometimes who's going to win the battle before it actually happens. It's pretty incredible. So obviously it's a great kind of way to tell a story. I mean, it's got all the drama, and sports movies make kind of great, you know, they're great stories because you have a very clear kind of protagonist you're rooting for. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, it's revolving around a team like with Invictus, where you have these guys who, I mean, basically the story of Invictus was this mostly white rugby team really was a symbol of apartheid as far as the black South Africans were concerned, and they wear green and gold uniforms, and their name is the Springboks. And one of the first things that happened when Mandela became president, there was a large movement within his own party to change the colors and the name of the national side because it was just a symbol for them of a time that they wanted to put behind them. And it was Mandela who fought against his own constituency and insisted on retaining the name and the colors because he had spent 27 years in prison studying, you know, the Afrikaners, and he spoke their language and he understood their culture, and he said, "You don't understand. If we don't embrace this team, and if they don't continue to represent South Africa and become our team, because up until that time, when a black South African would go to a rugby match or watch a rugby game, they would root for whoever was playing against the Springboks." Mm. And so it was Mandela who actually pulled his own constituents kind of towards this idea of embracing this this team, and he used this event, which was the 1995 World Cup, and it was being played in South Africa. So South Africa had just been invited back onto the world stage, and there were all these doubts about whether they could even compete at that level, and they got an automatic bye into the tournament because they were the host country. And so it's against that backdrop and against Mandela literally like grabbing the country and pulling it together, pulling all these disparate groups together, that this event actually played out. And he went to the captain of the team, who's the character that I play, and basically told him kind of in no uncertain terms that he was going to have to exceed his own expectations, and the team was going to have to exceed their own expectations, and they were going to have to win this thing because that act alone would bring the country together.
Matt Damon, the movie Invictus, comes out tomorrow, joins us here at Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio. Now, as you get older as an actor, I assume you start looking at stuff like this that has a great story that you want to be told and you want to be part of. So I imagine the research and the preparation physically, mentally is a little bit more than, say, Stuck on You going back a few years, correct?
I prepared really hard for Stuck on You. So
the researching of conjoined twins on Martha's Vineyard, I believe that was the backdrop
with
for that.
With Peter and Bobby Farrelly, right. Exactly, with my friends. Each movie's different. I mean, I love Stuck on You, and I love this movie. I know why I've made every movie that I've made, and you know, there are different times in my life or different moods that I'm in or different stories I want to tell, and I love the fact that I can tell a different one every 6 months, and I don't have to do the same thing over and over. I mean, it's one of the reasons people go into the arts is because you don't have to do the same thing every day. But this one had its own kind of interesting challenges because of, you know, the culture there and the accent and, you know, physically what the guy needed to look like. So it took me a long time to get ready, but I had about 6 months. And plus it was working with Clint, and it was working opposite Morgan, and not just working opposite Morgan, but working opposite Morgan playing this role, which was really one of those roles that I think, I mean, in all fairness, the guy was expected to play for quite some time. And even Mandela had said publicly before he and Morgan met, when he published his autobiography, they said, "If this ever gets made into a movie, who would you like to see portray you?" And he said, "Morgan Freeman." So that was 15 years ago. So there had been this kind of buildup, and everyone kind of in the industry knew that Morgan had been circling numerous Mandela projects, and this was the one that he settled on. So to be the actor kind of sitting across the table from him while he did this was also something that I really wanted to do.
Matt Damon, our guest here, Scott Van Pelt Show. You mentioned accents, and I'm sure that doing press for films must suck because you have to deal with idiots like us. And just to make it suck worse, we'll channel our inner Sully and Fitz here, and we'll, a few queries, if we might, regarding several instances in your career that I would like to know simply, where was the source of the anger with you and Vinny Chase on Entourage? Because, no offense, you came off like quite a prick to the guy.
Well, Vinny, you know, Vinny, he was kind of stonewalling me. You know, I made an overture to him. He seemed to, you know, to be responsive to it, and then he didn't come through for me. So I was just, you know, I think it came across perhaps as a little psychotic, but I was just kind of following up on a conversation we'd had.
I understand, but that's like 100% real to me, because see, I argue with my cousins all the time, and they tell me, "Dude, that's not even like Vinny Chase, ain't even a real guy." I'm like, "No, that was Matt Damon. I saw what happened," and they were arguing. So I mean, that was 100% real, like Jersey Shore,
dude,
correct?
Dude, professionalism.
What?
See, the problem is Matty D's Marky Mark's older brother. So that
incorrect.
Was the whole, no, dude, it's fact. Look it up. It's online on Wikipedia, dude. And when you look at that relationship, Maddie, I think you came correct.
This actually is starting to sound like Eddie Andelman's old, you know, sports show. Yeah, when you get like the caller.
I worked with Eddie for a long time,
is
so I don't know.
Is he a real person?
Yeah, no, he really is. He is real. Matt Damon, star of Ninja Bounty Hunter Season 2, joining us here on ESPN Radio. Question, and this may hit a nerve. Between the disappointments with the costume choices in Dogma versus not getting in at the ground level investment thing there with Ben Affleck's Affleck Insurance, what to you was been a bigger miss?
Well, look, you know, the hoods that we wore in Dogma were the director's choice. Kevin Smith, I love him to death. I stand by his creative decision making.
Runs house.
Back my director.
But
not getting in on Affleck was brutal, I have to say.
It's brutal because, I mean, you know, every time you're watching Nessun, you figure the duck is just haunting you.
Well, you know, more than that, what's worth its weight in gold is the fact that that's actually not my last name, because when I walk down the street in Boston, people don't scream Affleck at me, which is not the experience that I can say my friend Ben has.
Hey, but you know what, Matty? It's not your fault. See what I'm saying? It's not your fault.
Yeah, I know.
See what I did there?
That was actually genius. Ryan Russillo channeling his best from the vineyard. He's a tough kid from the streets from there. Matt, I know that this must be brutal. You deal with 100 idiots, and we're probably the two biggest among them. But I've been a fan of your work. I remember meeting you years ago at the Golf Channel when you were doing the Bagger Vance film. So congratulations on all the enormous success. Invictus is tomorrow. We wish you the best, man.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it, guys.
It's time for Scott Van Pelt's One Big Thing. One Big Thing. On ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
I am a recruit, Nick. I follow it because I'm a loser. So I've known the name John Wall for several years. I'm guessing that many of you are just getting to know who he is after his performance last night in New York City as Kentucky won. And you're getting to understand why so many people feel like this guy will be the number one pick in next summer's NBA draft. His skill set is obvious and it's silly. 25 points, 12 of the last 15 as Kentucky beat a good but not yet great UConn team. This makes 3 years in a row that John Calipari's had a freshman that's a special talent. And Coach Cal says Wall is more advanced at this stage than either Derrick Rose or Tyreek Evans were at Memphis. And you'll remember Derrick Rose went number one overall. And Tyreek Evans is a guy that, frankly, I was totally wrong about, as off about anything as I've been lately, besides picking the Detroit Lions to make the playoffs last year. I saw Evans play at this stage last year, and I thought there's no way that he's ready to go one and done. Evans, though, currently averaging 25-5 and playing like a grown man. He's part of why Sacramento's off to a surprisingly decent start. But to bring the discussion back full circle to Wall, the one and only thing that bums me out about what he represents is our infatuation with anything new, which presumes it's better than anything we had before. We love freshmen, but it's like, because we love the new thing, sophomores are obsolete, juniors are worse, and heaven forbid you're a senior, we can't even be bothered with you. Maybe it's just because I love college hoops so much. I wish kids like Rose and Evans were still in college, but that's not the world we live in. So I would encourage my friends in hoop-crazed Lexington to do this year what I am doing, which is enjoying your year with John Wall, with the understanding that in many ways it's like winter in Wisconsin, about a five-month proposition. He's real good.
Yeah, and I think that when people say he's better than Rose, as great as Rose was, I don't think that that's off, because I think he already has a better feel for some things than Rose did.
And if he consistently buries a 20-footer, forget it, because he can get to the cup anytime he wants.
The Scott Van Pelt Show. Weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. For more of the best that ESPN Radio has to offer, tune in from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern for the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and online at ESPNRadio.com.